much they abuse drugs and alcohol, and even, to some extent, how involved in violence they become. The study also showed other important factors that affect these behaviors, such as whether an adolescent's parents are present during key periods of the day, or whether the child's parents have high or low expectations of his or her academic performance. But these factors paled in significance to the connection factor. Such connection, according to the study, involves closeness to mother and or father, and a sense of caring from them, as well as feeling loved and wanted by family members. As we discussed in the prior two chapters on mothers and fathers, it is not a matter of being a moral policeman or warden, but rather of offering a boy succor from a world that's rough and creating a niche where he may express his most vulnerable and warm feelings in the open, without fear of ridicule. Role models, real heroes for boys. For any parent or other family member who doubts the kind of positive influence he or she can have on the adolescent boy, it's important to investigate exactly whom our boys say they look up to, who they claim their heroes really are. Despite the prevalent myth that boys' heroes are distant Olympian figures such as sports stars, astronauts, and the muscle-bound stars of action movies, my research reflects that in reality, most teenage boys find heroes closer to home. Brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers. In families with less traditional structures, such as in single-parent families, or in families with parents who have separated or divorced, boys often find these heroes in extended family members, such as aunts, uncles, and grandparents. These findings are buttressed by data from other research, such as the Horatio Alger study I cited earlier, which reports not only that the majority of teen boys respect their parents, but that over 10% of them saw their parents as heroes. Listen to the voices of the boys from our study when asked whom they emulate or see as a hero and why. Curtis, a 16-year-old raised almost exclusively by his divorced mother, named her as his foremost model and inspiration. "My mom is everything to me. She sacrificed so much so that I can go to good schools. She got me into art, which is what keeps me going, and what I hope will be my profession someday. She's opened a lot of doors for me. All the opportunities I have now are because of her." Michael spoke of the male-male mentor bond he felt with his brother. "Who is my hero? My brother. Definitely my brother. He is older, so I always looked up to him. I try to emulate what he does in my life. There is no doubt in my mind, when he came to Hillside School, that I was going to come to Hillside School. I still talk to him more than my parents do. He's at college, and I call him more. He tells me more stuff. We're best friends, and I've always looked up to him. He has really been my role model." Harry was grateful to his mother. "Well, my mother did everything. She put me in baseball. She took me everywhere. She worked all the time, but she did everything you could ask for. She was always around." But for some of the boys in my study, moms or dads were around somewhat less, and the earlier family generation became the models to emulate, the heroes of the next generation. As one boy explained when I inquired who his hero was, "When my father wasn't around, my grandfather was the one who taught me how to pitch. He was my father figure, and I look up to him like even to this day. He is definitely my mentor. He's just like a great guy." Another adolescent boy reports, "I adore my grandparents. They mean the world to me. I spend as much time as I can with them. I admire my grandfather as well as my grandmother. I admire them for completely different qualities. My grandfather was a police officer. He is just like a brilliant man. He reads all the time. He is always cracking jokes just to lighten the situation up. He is a complete people person, and everyone seems to love him. He never seems to get on anyone's bad side or anything like that. He always used to take me to the park and play baseball with me and stuff like that. When I was having trouble in Little League, he helped me out there. And when I was having trouble in school, he helped me there, too. My grandmother, he explained, is completely different. She is extremely smart. She reads all the time, too, but she is always forcing me to read. She would always read books to me when I was really young, all types of novels. My grandmother is an amazing cook. Anytime I go down there, they feed me like 6 or 7 times a day. And we can be certain that the sustenance this boy derived was more than culinary. As the statements of these boys attest, adolescent boys look for role models close to home. By and large, they feel tremendous admiration for the mentors in their family, and more than any other category of people, they see these relatives as their heroes and heroines. So for any parent or other family members who wonder how much of an impact they can have on their quickly developing son, much comfort should be derived from the fact that they, and not somebody else, are the ones these boys look to most for guidance, love, and support. As volatile as adolescence can be, and as frustrating as it may be at times for the parents of sons working their way through this trying period, I believe it is very important for parents to stay attuned to the voices of their adolescent boys and seek as many opportunities as possible to share the potency of connection. When parents do so, they lay the groundwork for a more meaningful relationship with their boys, one that later, when their sons have grown into men, is likely to flourish with a new kind of honesty and a new kind of closeness. What parents and families can do. When parents ask me how to do this, how to build strong, dynamic, quality connections with their adolescent sons, I stress several things. Discuss the complexities of adolescence honestly. Though it's normal to want to avoid the complex feelings that arise between boys and adults during the boy's adolescence, do your best to acknowledge these feelings openly. Be honest about not only the confused feelings you think the boy may be experiencing, but also about your own mixed-up feelings. For example, if you feel a rush of jealousy when your son is heading off for the prom night dinner, say to him, "You're not going to believe this, but part of me wishes I was young again and heading off to dinner with you." Or if your son seems to be constantly on the run and you miss spending close times with him, tell him you'd like to respect his need to become more independent, but that, yes, you've been missing him lately. There's a big difference between a parent who is trying to control or manipulate the adolescent boy and the parent who's being honest about wanting to reconnect with him. No matter how tough and independent he may act on the outside, you can rest assured that your boy, even as he develops into a man, will greatly appreciate hearing that you want to spend time with him. As you and he learn to balance your respective needs to remain interdependent, his years as an adolescent will become easier for both of you. Make regular dates with your son. While parents often spend a lot of time playing with their sons when they're young boys, many parents forget to find time for such parent-child play when these boys grow older. During adolescence, it's particularly important to make regular dates with your son to share in such family activities. Whether it's going out for ice cream, playing a sport together, or just hanging out in the den to watch a favorite television show, spending regular recreational time with your sons creates important opportunities for deeper kinds of sharing and connecting. As we've already discussed, many boys open up emotionally and relate best when they're given the opportunity to do something with somebody they love. While it's important to respect your son's need for time on his own and allow him the time he needs to fulfill his other interests and obligations, be sure to seek him out for shared activities on a regular basis. Don't wait to talk to him about sex, drugs, or other tricky topics. As we've seen, ignoring tough issues like sex and sexuality, AIDS, drugs, depression, and suicide simply does not help these issues go away for us or our sons. In fact, ignoring them may actually make a boy feel greater shame and be more likely to make unwise decisions. So don't lose any time. As soon as you think he's mature enough, and this age will vary, try to find the right place and moment, make sure it's okay with your son, and then plunge right in. Speak openly to your son about what you know and don't know about the perils and challenges of adolescence. Offer to explain anything he's curious about. If you feel embarrassed or afraid to talk about these issues, tell him so. Your honesty about your own hesitation will make him feel more comfortable talking to you as well. If you don't feel up to handling the talk on your own, do it as a team with your spouse, or have a family meeting with the boy's other siblings, if he has any, or consider getting together with close friends or neighbors to discuss these kinds of topics as a group. Of course, for both you and the boy, it's never easy to broach subjects like teenage sex or drug use. You're both bound to feel torn about how much to say and to experience moments of shyness or embarrassment. But in the end, resolving and moving beyond these inhibiting feelings is far easier than coping with a boy who's made an inappropriate or even deadly decision because he didn't have somebody he could talk to ahead of time. Setting a good example goes a long way toward instilling your values in the boy. But creating ample opportunities for him to talk with you, ask you a lot of questions, and share his concerns openly is what is most likely to help your son learn and respect the values you'd like to impart to him. Provide frequent affirmations. As often as possible, try to find opportunities to tell your son that you love him and to emphasize for him, in specific terms, all the things you treasure about him. Be sensitive to the shame he may feel inside himself. Even a boy who acts confident and self-assured on the surface feels vulnerable and needs to hear affirmations from his parents. As we've already seen, many times a boy's external armor of bravado and machismo may be hiding profound feelings of insecurity, loneliness, and low self-esteem. One of the most effective ways to help a boy conquer these demons is to tell him in the most genuine and explicit way all the things we cherish about him. An important aspect of this process of affirmation has to do with the boy's nascent sense of his identity as a man. Our boys yearn to have us provide clear, balanced expectations about masculinity, and to say supportive things that will help them build their confidence as they grow toward manhood. As your adolescent son begins to experiment with the behaviors he thinks we see as masculine and manly, stress how great you think he's doing, rather than conveying any messages that will make him feel confused or ashamed. So, for example, tell him how good you think he looks, even if that early mustache is a bit fuzzy. Compliment him on his personal accomplishments, whether they're in typically male or female domains, and support him as he begins to get involved in dating. By contrast, it's best that you don't do things such as tease him when he brings home a date, harass him about how quiet and cool he sometimes acts in the presence of his peers, or harangue him for acting so macho or for being an insensitive guy. Likewise, ideally, you should not bulldoze him into playing a sport when he doesn't want to. Tell him he smells funny when he splashes on Dad's cologne, or tell him to get a grip on himself when he comes home in tears one day. These kinds of mixed messages, some exhorting him to fulfill the new ideal of manliness, some pushing him to fulfill conventional ideas about masculinity, and some mocking his valiant attempts to make sense of everything, make it difficult for a boy to forge his own healthy, balanced sense of masculinity. Show that you understand the adolescent crucible. It's helpful to let your son know that you, as a fellow survivor of adolescence, understand just how rough the adolescent crucible can be. If you don't feel in touch with what the contemporary adolescent experience is all about, it's important to inform yourself as promptly and completely as possible. People who advocate teaching boys to just say no, or to agree never to fight, are largely ineffectual because these simplistic directives don't recognize what boys actually experience in the peer-governed world. Ideally, you should try to learn what it takes for today's boy to be considered cool, to belong to the central teen social circle, and to avoid being branded a wimp. To protect your boy, you must strive to become empathic to what this adolescent world is all about. Boys benefit enormously when you show that you appreciate how hard it is to be a boy dealing with peer pressure, society's expectations, and the other challenges of adolescence. So long as you do not lecture in a condescending way or exude the kind of pity or sarcasm that will only further shame our boys, often you can best communicate your love and understanding by telling war stories from your own adolescence. Sharing your own vulnerabilities as an adult helps the adolescent boy feel that he's not alone, that what he's feeling is normal. It also frequently enables the boy to begin to share his own experience. "But what I'm going through is different," he may begin, and then launch into the kind of open sharing of feelings that is so critical to his happiness and well-being. Listen empathically. When your boy begins to express what he's experiencing, try to listen carefully and empathically, and not interrupt. Once the boy finds the courage to take off his mask and expose his vulnerable feelings, what he needs most is a patient, non-judgmental, fully attentive listener. While you may feel very tempted to jump right in with advice or to try to cheer up the boy, simply try to listen and let the boy know that you sincerely appreciate what he's going through. This helps to make sure that he doesn't just retreat behind the mask and hide painful feelings, including those that might amount to depression, we really should know about. Often by asking further questions about what he's going through, or by simply inquiring, "How can I help make things go better?" the boy himself will suggest ways to improve his situation. Make your home a safe place. Finally, do your best to make family and home an asylum from peer culture and society's ambivalent demands about how to become a man. By remaining available at an optimal distance, moving in or out as the situation demands, you can create a safe place in which your boy, protected from shame and ridicule, can explore genuine emotion and vulnerability. Sometimes the sagest advice is that of the late Chaim Ginat. Don't just do something. Stand there. Ideally, you will provide for the boy what I call a revolving door. Don't pester, prod, or cling to him when he's not ready for interaction, but let him know that when the time's right for him, he's welcome to come through the door for a time of closeness. If, as he grows, you are able to cede control to your adolescent son in this way, allowing him to choose when and how much parent-son relating takes place, you will enable the boy to individuate at his own pace. While it may sometimes feel like an emotional roller coaster, letting your son push and pull, hold on and let go, and seek connection and then retreat, is far more effective than striking up a detached laissez-faire attitude that communicates a lack of interest in connection, or putting your own needs for closeness and companionship ahead of those of a young man striving to become his own person in his own way. So make home a haven for real boys, where both you and your sons can enjoy the chance adolescence offers for growth, renewal, and connection. For I believe that by doing so, you're creating the solid foundation for a new kind of closeness that can take shape when your boy becomes a man. Chapter 8. The World of Boys and Their Friendships. I tell him everything. Good things that happen, bad things that happen, everything. It's important to have someone to talk things over with. Sean, age 17, referring to his best friend, John. Puncturing the myth of the boy loner. Because our society is haunted by gender-stereotyped ideas about the mythic image of boys and men as stoic loners who thrive on solitude, we tend to misunderstand and greatly undervalue boys' friendships. Psychologists have often failed to see the significant ways in which boys express their yearnings for human closeness and connection. They have underestimated the degree to which boys rely on their closest male and female friends to survive. My research shows that, perhaps beyond what we have ever realized, close friendships are of paramount importance to boys. Part of the reason we do not fully appreciate the richness and prevalence of boys' friendships is that at first glance they may not appear as emotionally deep and meaningful as girls' relationships. However, upon a closer look, it is clear that boys have friendships of tremendous depth and intensity. Boys' friendships are simply governed by different rules and expressed differently than girls' friendships. To fully appreciate male friendships, we must put aside traditionally female standards of intimacy and attachment. In doing so, we may be surprised by what the psychiatrist Harry Stack Sullivan termed chumships, that is, boys' particular sense of camaraderie and love. For instance, in public, and especially under the watchful eyes of their peers, boys often use action-oriented behavior to express their connection to other boys. They may race each other, climb a tree together, or play against one another in tennis. Such behavior can be seen as doing together, or caring through action. In these settings, boys generally forgo the kind of quiet one-on-one verbal sharing that we typically associate with girls. Boys do share intimate moments of relating, but they tend to do so privately, away from the group, where such exchanges might expose them to shame or embarrassment. Furthermore, my research shows that in addition to their same-gender friendships, most boys develop healthy, positive, and deep relationships with girls. This finding undermines the myth that young pre-adolescent boys are always less mature than girls their age, and that because their play styles are different, boys and girls are unable to form important connections with one another. It also debunks the myths that adolescent boys are inept or uninterested in friendship with girls, and that boys this age impart love, affection, and empathy only in the context of sexual conquest. My research reveals that not only are boys capable of forming important platonic friendships with girls, but they are eager to do so and count on these friendships for emotional support and enhancement of their self-esteem. Lean on me. Boys helping out boys. 17-year-old Sean's face softens when I ask him about his friends. "My friends really helped me get through," he says gently. As an African-American boy living in a predominantly white town, Sean has had to face prejudice and ignorance. Small in stature, he has encountered a great deal of teasing from other boys. "It's been easier for me the past 2 years," Sean explains, "because now I have a group of friends who know me for who I am and accept me. I don't really need to change the way I act to conform." Sean is particularly grateful for his best friend, John, whom he's known since fifth grade. Sean and John talk every night on the phone. I tell him everything. Good things that happen, bad things that happen, everything. It's important to have someone to talk things over with. Yet, Sean also expressed appreciation for John's ability, the result of years of close companionship, to communicate without words. He knows everything about me. I mean, it's amazing. He knows more about me than I do. I don't even have to tell him things. It's funny, like, even though we can be doing separate things, when we're together, it's like we've always been together. Sean and John have shared a full range of experiences, good times and bad. Sean knows that John will always be there for him, no matter what. In fact, he credits John with saving his life. We were just 13 or 14 and boasting to these older guys about how much we could drink. We had some beers, and I got really, really drunk and sick. I passed out, threw up all over everything, and John took care of me. He put me on his back and carried me home. He took me to his house and put me in his bed. That was a huge thing. I mean, he saved me, basically. I was really struggling that night. If I'd been left to myself among those older kids, who we didn't know very well, who knows what would have happened? I could have died. John is clearly central to Sean's life. John is Sean's confidant, his best companion, and even at times his protector. Sean trusts him with his life. Perhaps what is most striking about Sean's story is that it is not atypical for boys today. Nearly all the boys I interviewed in my Listening to Boys' Voices project spoke of one or more friends to whom they felt extremely close. They readily described these friends as individuals who support them, care for them, and understand them in ways no one else does. Boys yearn for friendship with other boys. In our research interviews, when we asked, based on your experience growing up as a guy, what advice would you give to younger boys? Invariably, the answer centered on friendship. Make some close friends early, because people toss things around about you, and if you have a good friend, they won't listen to that kind of thing. The friendships you have may be small in number, but it's the strength of the friendship that counts. When you're younger, try to stay friends with different groups of kids. I think it's really helped me getting through, finding out what people are really like, not labeling. Don't get caught up with the wrong people. Respect your friends. They're what there is to fall back on. If you lose them, you pretty much lose everything. These boy-boy bonds follow a code of fairness and behavior all their own. Our study showed that implicit in this code are rules for being a friend, such as keep your cool, don't get bent out of shape, and stand up for your buddies. 17-year-old Michael described how his best friend helped him get through the darkest days of being a teenager. He met Chris 5 years ago when they started attending the same school. It was the first dance of seventh grade. I was standing around like, oh my God, girls everywhere. I had led a sheltered life so far. All the girls were on one side, the boys on another. You know how it is at younger kids' dances. Chris was actually over on the girls' side. He was one of two or three boys mingling with the girls. And I was like, wow, I should get some pointers. So Michael struck up a friendship with this savvy boy, hoping to learn how to be more sociable. Though the friendship started on a utilitarian note, it has withstood personal trials and the test of time. Last year, when Michael struggled with a bout of the blues, Chris was supportive. He listened without shaming Michael. Chris has been the person I've always been able to confide in, and he has always been able to help me out. He's been there for me. I know I can trust him. Lately, Michael has felt unable to confide in his parents and finds he relies all the more on Chris's support. I don't tell them as much because they tend to treat me as if I'm younger than I am. They want to protect me all the time. They wouldn't be able to understand why I was feeling sad, and it would just bum them out. Michael feels that his friendship with Chris helps safeguard him from further bouts of sadness. If something really bad happens, then you're bound to feel bad, but you have a sort of safety net with your friends which stops the initial cycle from starting up and you getting too down on yourself. The bond between Chris and Michael illustrates how boys often cherish and value their friendships. My research shows that boys rely heavily on friends to make it through their emotional ups and downs. Contrary to the image of the reclusive, antisocial, macho man, most boys have a few good friends they can lean on. Gender straitjacketing and homophobia. Our culture underestimates boys' friendships, primarily because we tend to underestimate all the emotional needs and abilities of our boys. As we've already discussed, even very young boys are shamed for showing any signs of neediness, dependence, sadness, or vulnerability. According to the old boy code, we expect our boys to be little men, tough, independent, autonomous creatures. We restrict how much affection they show one another. Society teaches us that boys and men are less in need of friends, close personal bonds, or connections. Furthermore, society often views open displays of empathy and affection from boys as somehow inappropriate. One boy, Matt, told us he went through a depression last year but felt unable to seek help because of these unwritten rules of masculinity. It's hard being a guy because you're expected not to really talk about your feelings. You're supposed to deal with everything yourself. Girls are expected to go off and talk to someone. Guys aren't really allowed to do that. Matt was able to talk to his best friend, Jim, and found relief in doing that. But he never revealed his sadness to his parents or to any other friends. He spoke to Jim only in private, out of earshot of his parents or others. Boys, early on, are taught to limit the ways they seek out and express friendship. They're encouraged not to talk about problems, especially problems that expose their feelings of worry, doubt, or sadness. In fact, they're discouraged from talking about anything too serious for fear of being seen as weak, vulnerable, or needy. In short, as not being a man. As 12-year-old Alan explains, "I'll talk to Kevin about what's up with me, but only like on the weekends away from school. If we talked about that kind of thing at school, people would say we're acting like girls." Or as 14-year-old Scott offered, "They'll say you're a wuss if you're a guy and start talking all mushy like you're on Oprah or something." Peter Egan, writer for the teen TV show Sweet Valley High, agrees. He says that on his show, few scenes show boys engaging in conversation on emotional topics. Egan continues, "It just wouldn't be true. Boys just don't act like that. Boys know that if they say anything sappy to each other, they'll be humiliated and called a fag. Indeed, it's this very fear, the fear of being labeled a fairy, a wuss, or a fag, of being perceived as feminine or homosexual, that often prevents boys from feeling comfortable engaging in serious emotional talks with each other. It too often inhibits boys from ever saying they care for each other. It often prevents them from expressing physical affection for other boys. It allows adults to put a low premium on the kind of tender, loving friendships among boys that, with few exceptions, we encourage among girls. I was recently privy to one sad episode in the lives of 2 third-graders. The incident illustrates how open displays of affection among boys are often misperceived. Tommy and Charlie became fast friends during the summer after 3rd grade. When they discovered that they were going to be in the same class together in the fall, they eagerly anticipated the start of school. On the first day, their new teacher, Mrs. Hutchins, asked the students to copy a homework assignment and begin math problems. As the class settled down, Charlie walked in late. Before Charlie could take his seat, Tommy spotted his buddy in the doorway. Tommy excitedly flung himself across the room and gave Charlie a heartfelt hug. Mrs. Hutchins turned around to find the two of them, as she saw it, struggling and fighting in front of the entire class. Aghast, she sent them both directly to the principal's office. "We weren't fighting," the boys explained to Mr. Atkins, the principal. "We were just hugging." To demonstrate, Charlie planted a kiss on Tommy's head and added, "We're best friends. We like each other." Mr. Atkins was not impressed. "I guess Mrs. Hutchins was confused in thinking you were fighting. But such sexualized behavior is inappropriate in the classroom. I'm sending you back to class now, but I want you to take these letters home for your parents to sign." Mr. and Mrs. Simmons, Charlie's parents, later told me they were quite baffled when they received the letter. "What do they mean, Charlie, that you were sexually inappropriate in class? What exactly happened?" "I just hugged Tommy." "That's not a problem," Charlie's parents said. The next morning, Mrs. Simmons found herself sitting in Mr. Atkins's office. "This is the kind of affectionate behavior we love in our son. Why are you punishing him for it?" "As you will see in the pupil's manual, inappropriate touching and sexual expression are explicitly forbidden," said the principal. "So you mean that if two girls in the fourth grade were working closely together on a project, and one hugs the other, Mrs. Hutchins would be afraid of violence, and you would send them home for sexual activity?" Mr. Atkins's eyes widened, and he hesitated. "We would have to evaluate the circumstances of the specific situation," he finally said. Mrs. Simmons left, hoping the principal would rethink his stance. But she was saddened, too, wondering if she should counsel her son about limiting his displays of affection for Tommy at school to avoid further trouble. Unfortunately, Mr. Atkins's assumption that the boy's friendship was sexually inappropriate is hardly unusual. The gender straitjacket, combined with the absurd link that is often made between boyhood affection and adult male homosexuality, creates a restrictive environment. Boys are frequently pushed away from one another when they exude even a modicum of overt genuine love or affection for one another. This misguided perception, a form of homophobia, is perhaps most regrettable because it may lead us to undermine boys' friendships before they've even taken hold. Ironically, this may, in turn, cause us to doubt whether boys are capable of intimate friendship. And as we've seen in Chapter 7, it pushes some boys to turn to drugs and alcohol, substances that temporarily mute the shame they feel about their genuine longings for friendship, love, and affection. Is it any wonder that a society that fails to celebrate boys' friendships breeds men who fail as friends in their adult relationships with women? If we separate and shame young boys who show such affection for one another, how can we fault men for being incapable of showing non-sexual affection to their female partners? Similarly, why do we fault men for their inability to empathize with women while we discourage boys from embracing friends in need? The answers to these questions have to do with our gender stereotypes and the shame we heap on boys who rebel against them. I have long felt that a boy able to express his emotions in an open way, far from being a wimp or a sissy, is a hero, engaged in a true act of courage. Ideally, this kind of uninhibited love and caring between boys would not be seen as unusual, much less courageous. Ideally, it would just be part of every real boy, and something we'd celebrate in him. Boys' Play Styles. On a recent trip to an elementary school playground, I watched as most of the boys engaged in a rowdy game of kickball. At the plate was a small, nervous-looking boy named Brian. From the outfield, a larger boy jeered, "Hey, Brian, Brian, Brian! Hey, Brian, why you tryin'?" The outfielder grinned at his own cleverness, then started in again. "We got you beat! You can't take the heat!" Soon the other boys on his team chimed in. The budding rapper in the outfield was clearly delighted with himself, until one of Brian's teammates yelled, "Hey, Cruzy, shut up!" When Brian kicked a short, foul ball, Cruzy and his buddies went wild with derogatory yells. The girls were playing very differently. On the play gym, four girls raced up the ladder and flew down the slide, usually in pairs, holding one another tightly and shrieking in unison. A second group of three played near the building. One girl demonstrated a dance in earnest, her hands waving in the air, her feet tapping, and her head thrown back dramatically, a schoolyard rumba queen. "Okay, you try," she said to the others as she finished. The other two imitated her steps with a lot of giggles and much less conviction. The dancer clapped and laughed. "Great!" Soon they were all tapping and twirling together. These scenes are reenacted in playgrounds across the country. Researchers examining play in elementary school children find consistent patterns. Boys and girls cluster in same-sex groups. The play within these groups differs considerably. Boys tend to engage in active, competitive games. Girls, on the other hand, tend to play cooperatively in smaller groups. Boys enjoy structured games with set rules and procedures. Taunting, boasting, and jousting with one another is part of the fun. Boys argue often during games, but their arguments seldom end the game. When they can't agree, they resort to the rule book or just repeat the play. They seem to value the rules and procedures that govern the game and make it fair for all participants. They learn, as one teacher told us, to argue and hold no grudges. In other words, boys seem to be good at agreeing to disagree. Their friendships are resilient, surviving even the roughest play and disagreements. Boys' games tend to be competitive and inclusive. Their play creates an open arena in which each tests his skills against the others. This competitive attitude pervades other parts of boys' lives. As one junior at an all-boys school told us, competition among guys is all over the place, whether in the classroom or athletic field. You see this kind of jockeying for position. Who is better than whom? Who's the best looking? Who is numero uno? No matter what you do, you're always going to be competing with another guy for something. This spirit of competition, however, is generally less about one boy triumphing over another and more about engaging in a mutual challenge. Sweating side by side, boys, as we'll see in Chapter 11, struggle to achieve their personal best. Competition among boys is more about competing with another boy than competing against him. Boys seem to enjoy asserting themselves with other boys. Boys like making their presence known and appreciated. They like feeling competent at the activities and tasks in which the other boys are participating. In fact, research shows that the men who remember feeling competent in play with other boys have higher self-esteem as adults. Conversely, Men who suffer from low self-esteem often recall having felt left out of friendships with other boys when they were growing up, not feeling cared for or loved by other boys, or feeling as though they had failed at boys' competitive play. Donnie, one of the younger participants in our study, put it this way. I guess what makes the friendship is the fact that we both share common interests in imagination and are both pretty smart, so we can have good talks. But there is an element of competition with my best friend being in the same school. It's mild-mannered competition, very mild. Less obvious than the competitive and jousting quality of boys' play is the serious nature of the intimate bonds boys form while playing together. Many great friendships are born of shared experiences on the basketball court or on the Boy Scout sleepover. A quirky little movie set in a small Irish town, War of the Buttons, is wonderfully illustrative. In the film, a group of boys divides into two warring camps. Their pseudo-battles are serious and protracted. When a boy has the misfortune of getting caught by an enemy, he loses his buttons, tie, and belt. Toward the end, the two team leaders, Jerome and Fergus, are left alone. As they sit together, Jerome asks Fergus, "Why were we fighting?" To which Fergus casually replies, "For the hell of it, of course." A raucous pillow fight ensues. The last scene is a still shot of Jerome with Fergus in a head hold, both boys roaring with laughter. The audience feels the boys' powerful connection. Male friendship can arise from the most unlikely circumstances. Amid battling, swearing, and conspiring against one another, the boys' respect and fondness for one another grew. Girls' play usually centers more on talking and socializing within a small circle of friends. Girls' friendships solidify through shared confidences. Girls are more likely to discuss quietly than to yell and taunt. When a conflict does arise, girls often stop the game until the problem can be resolved to each player's satisfaction. Girls will generally talk it out before they consult the rule book. Their friends' feelings are of greater concern than continuing the game. Research shows that when girls are asked what makes them feel good about themselves, they tend to recall a time when they helped a friend. Overall, where boys care more about fairness and following and enforcing rules, girls worry more about their standing among friends. Girls are especially concerned with whether they are well-liked and will be included in their friends' activities. The comments of a friend's daughter, who discussed her Beanie Baby Club with me, are telling. "We're starting this club for Beanie Babies. We like to collect them and trade them," says 7-year-old Jesse Streeter. "It's going to be fun, because we can do things together and get more Beanie Babies, even though my parents won't buy me any more." Jesse's twin sister Allison explained further. "We're figuring out the numbers. We have 4 members so far, and we're trying to pick 1 more member without hurting anyone's feelings. We don't want it to be too big, because then it won't be as much fun." "The whole process has been very complicated," their mother said. "Since they thought up the idea a few weeks ago, they've been on the phone every afternoon, planning activities, selecting dates, and going through an elaborate decision-making process about the other members." "I wanted Sarah, and Ellie wanted Sarah, but Allison wanted Perry," says Jesse. "If we had Sarah, though, then Cynthia might have gotten mad, because Sarah and Cynthia are best friends. And if we had Perry, then Ellie and I would be mad, because we think Perry's too bossy." Mrs. Streeter has been amused, but also impressed by the process. "We've had some good conversations about including people, about compromise, and about people's feelings. Like the Streeter twins and their friends, many girls are as comfortable talking about and negotiating the process of games as they are playing them. They seem to focus less on the outcome than on who gets to participate and on how that affects the other girls. Of course, the play of boys and girls does not always fall into neat categories. We are all familiar with boys who shy away from rough and tumble play, and girls who love getting revved up for a fierce game of basketball, soccer, hockey, or another competitive sport. There are plenty of girls with an ample sense of competition, and plenty of boys who care immensely about being well-liked and included in the central playgroup. Recognizing general gender differences in play styles is important, however, because these differences may contribute to our misconceptions about their friendships. For when it comes to boys, it is often through their rowdy play that they build friendships. Underneath the rough-and-tumble games where boys are seeking to feel part of the action and striving for excellence in the company of their buddies, they are building relationships. Harry Stack Sullivan recognized the importance to boys of these close chumships. He described boys' friendships as a form of love. Through these love affairs, he said, boys are able to develop a more accurate self-image and a stronger sense of personal worth and enhanced self-esteem. Intimacy for boys and intimacy for girls. Integral to genuine friendships is intimacy. As we have seen, boys achieve significant intimacy in their relationships with other boys, although they often experience it differently than girls. Because of societal taboos that discourage open displays of caring between boys, their intimate connections get pushed underground. The intimacy occurs quietly, privately, almost invisibly. Researcher Scott Swain has defined men's style of intimacy as covert intimacy, an intimacy that is expressed unobtrusively and silently. When a boy's best friend is leaving town for the summer, he is more likely to offer a goodbye hug to his pal when no one else is around. When a quarterback makes a great pass to clinch the game, his teammates are more likely to give him a quick pat on the back, or offer succinct words of praise such as, "Great pass," or "Nice going," than to tell him how proud they are of him. To help us understand boys' brand of intimacy, Swain talks about behavior in the context of a friendship that connotes a positive and mutual sense of meaning and importance to the participants. In other words, intimacy encompasses whatever behaviors make people feel close to one another. It is important to support boys in experiencing these moments of connection with one another. I encourage parents to gently reinforce them. Fathers can tell stories about their own buddies. Mothers can share their own special friendships, with girls or with boys, from childhood. Parents can reinforce behavior by telling a boy, "That was really nice the way you complimented Bobby on his great pass." Or, "What a great idea to invite Hal over for dinner. He must be glad to have your friendship now that his dad's moved out." Without embarrassing him, we let him know that boy-boy bonding is valuable, and that the intimacy he's able to achieve is not only appropriate, but commendable. Boys do talk. One of the most surprising findings from my interviews was how much these allegedly nonverbal boys were talking. In fact, according to some of these boys, they rival their sisters in phone usage. Guy told us he talks to Connor, his best friend, at least twice a day. "When I get home from school and before I go to sleep, and then in the morning he picks me up for school and he calls me from the car before he gets here. Yeah, we talk a lot. These boys process everything with the intensity of any two girls. We talk about everything. Sports, girls, school, our parents. We're a lot alike, so he can sort of look through my eyes in a situation. 16-year-old Ed says humor and conversation are what bind his friendship with Jamal. We think exactly the same, and we really make each other laugh a lot. I think that he's probably the funniest kid I know, and he thinks I'm the funniest kid he knows. Talking to him is so easy. I know I can call him and talk to him about pretty much anything. Sometimes I just want to talk about nothing, just joke and laugh. And sometimes I have something I really need to ask him about. What should I do, and what do you think about that? There are certain things that you don't want to talk about with just anybody, and it's good to be able to talk to him. Once again, however, there is a covert aspect to these conversations. Ed talks to Jamal about things he can't tell anyone else. Guy and Connor talk in the privacy of their homes. No one is aware of the extent to which these boys process their feelings together, except, perhaps, the phone company and the parents who pay the phone bill. At times, some boys may expect different things from their conversations than girls do. In particular, they may express their natural empathy in a different manner. When boys are sad, they often expect a friend to try to talk to them and cheer them up. I always have people around to cheer me up, so I don't get down that often. When things go wrong, I talk to my friends and get it off my chest, says 15-year-old Curtis. As Sean puts it, when my friends are feeling down, I try to talk to them, bring their spirits up a bit, because I know how much it helps me. There is nothing worse than feeling sad or frustrated and having no one to talk to. Yet when boys are feeling down, they don't always expect their friends to lend a sympathetic ear. Quite the opposite. Boys sometimes tease and insult one another when emotions are running highest. When Paul was going through a hard time, he turned to Tim. We usually end up dealing with our problems in a comical way, says Paul. We always end up making light of it. It's easier to handle. Jeremy tells how Brett goofs on him to cheer him up. One day, I was in a really bad mood. I had totaled my car that morning, and I was an hour late. Brett was egging me on, teasing me about stuff. It had nothing to do with the car. I took my shoes off, and a moment later my shoes were gone. I was getting pissed, and I would go, "Just give them to me." But he kept it up, and I finally ended up laughing and punching him. Indeed, boys may also expect contradiction from their close buddies. Contradiction may enhance their friend's capacity for perspective on emotionally charged issues. As Tony explained, I think it's important to talk. Oh, I think it's helpful because it's definitely good to see their perspective on things, and it helps to know if they disagree. It kind of makes you want to rethink your decision, and that's very helpful. Boys may avoid direct expressions of sympathy. The "oh, you poor thing" approach is heard by some boys as condescending, as implying a deficiency in the boy in trouble. And while it might be all right to admit a weakness to a very close friend, it's not something most shame-sensitive boys dwell on. Boys may far prefer a friend saying, "What a jerk," or "No way, that's ridiculous," or "That sucks. Now let's go play ball," to "How can I make you feel better?" or "How are you going to get through this?" And when boys are confused or upset, they may prefer direct advice. Jeremy says he turns to Brett for advice when he has problems. I can tell him anything, because it's almost like he's going through it too. There are a lot of situations that I can talk to him about, and he gives me an honest answer. I know in all seriousness that he would give me the best advice he could. Biases and blind spots. Other reasons we don't value boys' friendships. As we saw earlier, our difficulty in valuing boys' friendships stems in part from unwitting biases and blind spots. Researchers of child behavior are certainly not immune to these influences. On the whole, many researchers have missed the importance of boys' relationships because they too have applied what they have known about girls' relationships or adult female relationships as a benchmark to understand relationships among boys. Unfortunately, when researchers misunderstand boys' behavior, we as a society are often led to adopt the same misguided viewpoints. To get a sense of how highly sophisticated researchers distort our view of boys, let's consider the work of noted psychologist Eleanor Maccoby, who in one widely cited 1990 review study examines the differences in conversational style between boys and girls. In this study, Maccoby concludes that a boy tends to use speech to serve egoistic functions, such as to establish and protect his turf. Among girls, she says, conversation is a more socially binding process, used to create feelings of connectedness rather than rivalry. She labels boys' speech patterns as restrictive, a style that tends to derail an interaction. Examples are threatening a partner, directly contradicting or interrupting, topping the partner's story, boasting or engaging in other forms of self-display, she writes. In contrast, she calls girls' speech patterns enabling, which means that by acknowledging another's comments or expressing agreement, girls tend to extend the conversation. She concludes, "I want to suggest that it is because women and girls use more enabling styles that they are able to form more intimate and more integrated relationships. Also, I think it likely that it is the male concern for turf and dominance, that is, with not showing weakness to other men and boys, that underlies their restrictive interaction style and their lack of self-disclosure." Clearly, Maccoby's statements are based on broad assumptions. She says that the girl's enabling speech style keeps conversations going longer and therefore leads to greater intimacy. This view makes the assumptive leap that conversation equals intimacy. As we have seen, intimacy can arise from any shared activities that bring people closer together. Intimacy can be born of a doing together in which caring or empathy finds expression. Maccoby also assumes that behaviors such as contradicting or topping the story of the speaker will necessarily limit an interaction. However, for boys perhaps more accustomed to teasing, I believe that contradiction can in fact prolong a good-spirited argument. Topping another story can be an invitation for continued storytelling. Other researchers are equally quick to judge little girls as relational experts and little boys as lagging far behind. Deborah Tannen, author of You Just Don't Understand, asked second-grade girls and boys to talk about something serious. The girls told stories about accidents and illnesses that have hurt people they care about. The boys, however, couldn't seem to settle down and bring themselves to do any serious talk. They ran around the room, telling scatological jokes, searching for games to play, for something to do, and taunted or teased each other. Tannen interprets what happened as showing girls' natural ability to be in relationships, and boys' greater need for status, independence, and action, which gets in the way of relationships. Boys are so competitive with each other, Tannen and Maccoby seem to believe, so concerned with one-upmanship and activity, that they ride roughshod over one another's feelings and lose the ability to connect with one another in any meaningful way. If we understand the developmental path of boys, we view these behaviors differently. For instance, I would suggest that the boys in Tannen's study are less Machiavellian princes, concerned with power and dominance, than they are our own real boys. They are boys trying to make friends, be accepted by the group, and avoid rejection or humiliation. If we shift our focus from friendship to what psychologists call pro-social activity, that is, doing something positive with or for a friend, we discover that these boys are, in fact, in the early stages of what I've called doing together, or what psychologist Ronald Levant has referred to in Adult Men as a form of action empathy. A boy knows that were he to sit down and talk about his disappointing grades, his mother's illness, or his lonely weekends, he would be breaking the boy code, the code of masculinity. Responding to the researcher's demands to talk seriously may bring him shame and humiliation. Why would any boy let down his protective macho mask in front of a researcher he hardly knows and whom he likely doesn't trust? What most boys probably do instead is energetically not comply. The boy's rebellious outbursts and foul language may well reflect the tensions of an impossible assignment. In fact, much of the boy's group behaviors that were observed likely stemmed from this sort of compensatory response. Boys learn they have to put on an act to get by, to wear a tough guy mask to avoid being teased. When someone teases you, you learn you can't back down, says Sean. You have to step up and show you're even tougher than he is. Why is action empathy any less deep and meaningful than the verbally intimate moments shared among girls and young women? Why should John and Hal, shirtless, bending over John's motorcycle, attempting to adjust the throttle while intermittently slapping each other on the back and spraying water on each other's heads, be projecting a model of friendship any less meaningful than Amy and Ellen working out together at the all-women's gym and discussing Andrea's difficulty telling her new boyfriend that she's not yet ready for sex? So it seems boys may follow their own formula for friendship. Start with action and energy, throw in loyalty, laughter, and doing together. Add covert verbal expressions of caring, earnestness, and hidden physical touching, and you get a good friend. This formula may differ completely from that for a girl's friendship, but it may be no less real or intimate. My most striking personal encounter with a researcher's blind spots toward boy friendships occurred when I saw the movie Stand By Me. I went to this movie with a female researcher. In the literature of books and motion pictures that explore friendships among boys, this 1986 film, in my estimation, is one of the more genuine and realistic works. Four boys embark on an adventure to find the body of a missing boy. The boys face external dangers as well as internal ones. They talk about the death of a brother, a teacher's betrayal, and their fears for the future. They comfort each other, protect each other, and end up closer than ever. The woman colleague with whom I viewed this film was startled and somewhat repelled by the boys' friendships in the movie. She was amazed at the way these self-described best friends addressed one another with insults and taunts. Granted, I too was impressed by the number and variety of derogatory names that these boys threw at one another. However, she was particularly struck by the line, "Finding new and preferably disgusting ways to degrade one's mother was always held in high regard." She was further aghast at how often these so-called best friends physically insulted each other by dunking each other in a muddy swamp, putting each other in head holds, or displaying a wide repertoire of playful slaps, kicks, and punches. In short, she seemed to feel that this movie with these boys was the predecessor of Lord of the Flies. I didn't argue with her, but the very behaviors that repelled her about the boys were also what made the movie a realistic depiction of how many a 12-year-old interacts. I saw their interactions in a completely different light. I came